So many people like us who come from broken families struggle with feeling helpless and even needing. We might even feel like we're too much for the people around us. And our efforts toward healing and growth might feel kind of fruitless, like we're spinning our tires in mud, but we're never really getting anywhere. Now, maybe that's not you, but maybe you know someone who struggles in that area, a friend, a parent, a boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever. Either way, this episode is going to help you. In it, you're going to learn things like the simple solution to beat neediness and helplessness from a trauma therapist, why struggles are actually good for you, what this looks like if you have a disability. We answer the question, does grieving have a place? And the most important question that you can ask to move beyond grief. Again, if you've struggled with feeling like you're too much, feeling helpless, stuck, or needy, or maybe you know someone who struggles in that way, this episode is for you. Stay with us. Welcome to the Restored Podcast, helping you heal and grow from the trauma of your parents' divorce, separation, or broken family so you can break the cycle. I'm your host, Joey Panarelli. This is episode 121. As we often say on this show, we're so happy that this podcast has been helpful and even healing for you. We've heard so much great feedback. One listener said this, "Only God knows where I would be if this ministry didn't exist." Again, we're so happy to hear it's been helpful and even healing. We do it for you. Today's episode is sponsored by Dakota Lane Fitness. If you've ever felt intimidated by working out, eating healthy, or perhaps you've tried workout programs and meal plans that just didn't work for you, then this is especially for you. Dakota Lane is a nationally certified fitness and nutrition coach who's helped about 1,000 clients worldwide, including moms of 10 kids, CEOs, MLB baseball players, 75-year-olds, and people who've never even stepped foot in a gym. Dakota builds customized fitness and nutrition plans with around-the-clock accountability and one-on-one coaching for people anywhere in the world in a safe and approachable environment. But what else makes Dakota different than the numerous fitness and nutrition coaches out there? Three things. One, he's done it himself. He's a very healthy, ripped dude. He's also a good, virtuous man too, not just caught up in his body and his looks. Two, he actually studied to become a priest for a little while. And from that experience and his time at Franciscan University and the Augustine Institute, he developed the belief that to live a fully human life involves not just growing in one area, such as your spiritual life, and neglecting the rest, like your body. We really need to care for it all so we can become more virtuous and free to love. And the third thing is Dakota's mission is not just to help people, you know, get ripped, but to lead them to experience the highest quality of life through intentional discipline and treating their bodies the way that they were made to be treated. And so if you desire that freedom, if you desire transforming your body and your life, Dakota can help you. One client said this, "Dakota Lane changed my life. And the best part is that what I once thought was impossible was made so doable and realistic by Dakota. This program is worth every penny. If you have struggled in the past and can't seem to find a way to change yourself for the better, look no further. Dakota Lane is your man." And so if you want to see what Dakota offers and the amazing results that his clients have experienced, just go to DakotaLaneFitness.com or click on the link in the show notes. My guest today is Margaret Vasquez. Margaret holds a bachelor's degree in theology and a master's degree in counseling, both from Franciscan University of Steubenville. She is a licensed professional clinical counselor with supervisory designation, holds numerous trauma certifications, is certified in Myers-Briggs, and is the founder and director of Sacred Heart Healing Ministries. For the past 18 years, she has treated clients of all ages from all around the world. She has appeared on numerous episodes of Women of Grace on EWTN, as well as many radio shows and podcasts. She's the author of More Than Words, The Freedom to Thrive After Trauma, and Fearless, Abundant Life Through Infinite Love. She hosts the Wholeness and Holiness podcast, a weekly podcast on human and spiritual integration. She provides healing missions, retreats, one-week individual healing programs, and intensive trauma therapy. Her passion is for all people to come to know the surpassing love of God. And lastly, she is the instructor of our video course at Restored called Broken to Whole, Tactics to Heal from Your Parents' Divorce or Broken Marriage. And so if you're interested in that, I'll tell you more at the end how you can get that. It's free actually right now. It might change in the future, but I'll tell you more at the end of this episode. And by the way, in this episode, we do talk about God and faith. If you don't believe in God, you're totally welcome here. Anyone who's been listening to this show for a while knows that this is not a religious podcast. If you don't believe in God, I would just challenge you to listen with an open mind. Even if you just skip or take out the God part, you're still going to benefit so much from this episode. if you do have kids around, I recommend just maybe putting in some earphones, because we do talk about some mature topics in this episode. And finally, we do jump back and forth a bit between the mental and emotional aspects of this problem of neediness, helplessness. And so in my mind, those are distinct different things. But in this conversation, we kind of meld them together. And so when you hear the word mental, you can also think of the word emotional too. With that, here's my conversation with Margaret. Margaret, welcome back. So good to have you.
It's always great to be with you, Joey.
I want to dive right in. There's, I think, this temptation we all face, all of us, when it comes to healing and growth, and that is that we consume information, right? We listen to podcasts, we read books, we attend retreats, all really good things to gain knowledge, but we never really take action on what we're learning. Like, we don't transform, we don't apply what we've learned. And it's kind of crass, but I've heard some people say that, you know, it's kind of like a mental masturbation where we get this high from learning, but it doesn't really lead to much. And so two questions there. What's happening here and why do we do that?
Actually, even though it is crass, I like that explanation, because it doesn't bear fruit and it just creates like a lot of emotion. You know what I mean? So just a lot of emotion. There's a lot of feeling going on, but like there's no fruit. The same as masturbation. So there is a... To me, it kind of fits. So what's going on there? I kind of look at it like come from a number of places. I actually had a person, this person was actually a friend, not a client, but said to me, now had been through definitely painful growing up, painful childhood. But this person actually said, no, it's not fair for me to have to, basically, she was talking about taking care of herself emotionally. No, it's not fair. I deserve to have been taken care of by somebody else as a child. And so I'm not going to take care of me now. And I was just like shocked that anybody would actually say, we're not friends anymore. It was not based on that. There was more to it than that. But I just was like, wow, how astounding that somebody would actually be cognizant of that. And then just deciding like, no, it's not fair. And so I'm not going to do that. I think for some people, I like to think that for people, it can maybe even more often not be something that they're consciously aware of, and maybe that they feel like they're like they can't take care of themselves, like they're, you know, incapable. Maybe it's more of that. I like to think that, because it's hard for me to think somebody just decides like to dig their heels in and refuse, you know. So then it leads to outsourcing that care of our emotional selves to other people, because my need for emotional self-care isn't going to go away. My own personal growth and responsibility and the need for that isn't going to go anywhere. If I'm not taking care of it myself, then going to intentionally or unintentionally kind of be approaching the world with kind of, I'd look at it like constantly job posting, right? Here's my unpublished classified ad of like, are you the little kid book, right? Are you my mommy? Do you remember that book? The little bird falls out of his nest and he's walking through and he's asking like this big bulldozer, like, are you my mommy? And he's like walking through like the world, are you my mommy? And we kind of end up walking through the world kind of with this attitude, like, are you my mom? Are you my dad? Will you take care of me? Sort of thing. If we're not doing it ourselves, because that, I look at it like that need for self-care, for kind of for parenting doesn't go away just when we hit 18 or move out of our parents' homes or whatever, but it becomes incumbent on us to do that ourselves. Of course, finding the right resources and of course, all of this would be, from my perspective, relying on the Lord's help, but then it's kind of taking on the mind of Christ towards that care, to be that need for love directed to him first. But then I have to like actually change my self-talk to line up with his, because if I'm going like, God, make me feel loved, but then my constant self-talk is I'm terrible and everybody's better than me. And, you know, God couldn't really love me because if you knew how I'm all the different, you know, ways I'm terrible, like, you know, you'd understand. So we just deflect his love, right? So we kind of go to him with this big bowl asking him to fill it and we have a lid on it, you know, or can kind of look at it like our metaphorical love bucket and we're just poking holes in it. And so, you know, he's pouring Niagara Falls into it, but at the end of the day, it's still empty because of all the holes I've jabbed in it. So then we still end up feeling empty. And so then we turn to the person who's right in front of us to get that need met.
100%. Now, I think one thing to add there too is like, you said this so well, there is a real need there. it's just a matter of like, how do you go about filling that need? We're not like putting that down. We're not saying, you know, you don't need other people in your life. We're just saying the relationships just need to be healthy, right? And we need to go to God first. And then from there, you know, we can experience the love of other people. And that could be incredibly healing. But if things are upside down, then it just becomes this, like you said before, this vicious cycle where there's a lot of motion or, you know, we never like gain ground. Basically, there's a lot of like movement, but never gaining any ground. And I think not only is it frustrating for the people in your life around you who might be like trying to help you, but it's also frustrating for you. Because it's like, man, I just seem like just stuck. Like, again, I might be moving my feet a lot, but I'm never moving forward.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember being in that spot, like, you know, before I went through trauma therapy, actually, because I was just in such an emotionally needy spot. And I didn't really understand how these, I feel like we don't get taught how these things fit together, you know, but working on a book on that. But without understanding how these things work together on a very just kind of just even visceral, like level, like feeling such a desperate need for love, like kind of being in that place, like that job posting thing, it ends up leading to rejection because right. that neediness, right? And then that becomes, and it, I think it leads to rejection because others have their hands full taking care of their own emotional selves and their lives, right? And so when we kind of have that feeling like somebody's trying to get from me what I'm busy over here doing it for myself, like you do it for yourself too, and like it'll be fine. Then we can relate to each other like adults and from a place of peace instead of you're trying to get from me what only the Lord can do for you. And then you need to really, really receive and take on and kind of do for yourself as well. If we're not doing that, right, if we're outsourcing that to someone else, they're kind of, whether they're cognizant of it or not, it kind of makes us feel like our insides are twisting, you know, and we're like, it's kind of an icky feeling. And so we just kind of, we inadvertently like push that person away. And so then to the being the person on that end, it's a feeling of rejection. And so I think the cycle is then the person becomes that much more, they don't understand that dynamic, right? And so then they really internalize the way their behavior is being responded to as being essential to who they are. Does that make sense? Like, I'm rejectable. I'm not lovable. It's like, no, you're fine. Like, just don't do that. Like, you know what I mean? So yeah, I think it really creates like a vicious cycle.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think the experience, and we are like, we're empathizing with people who've been there because I've been there too, where you just feel this immense amount of need. Like you feel the real need underneath it all and you just take it to the wrong source. Like I've done that. But I think this experience of feeling like you're too much, I've heard people say that a lot. Like, I feel like I'm just too much. Like no one can really handle me. There can then be that, like you said, that regression where it's like, well, this is just the way that I am. And other people aren't strong enough to handle my stuff. Therefore, I'm doomed to this life of loneliness and, you know, self-pity and all this stuff that's really, it's depressing. It's sad. And again, I've been there.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be like that. I think just understanding how it works then is really a game changer, because the way I see it is like we each plug into the Lord first. And I don't mean first, like, okay, first, like that box is checked. Now moving on to time to plug into somebody else. No, it's like, that's a foundational source. And if we do that and staying connected in that way, now he's going to be able to supply all of those emotional needs, like infinitely more than we could ask or imagine. And even if we don't feel it in a warm, fuzzy way all the time, right? But the more I begin to like align my way of seeing myself with how he sees me, then like St. Thomas Aquinas says, what's received is received according to the mode of the receiver, right? So if my mode is I'm not lovable, I can participate in whatever workshops or listen to whatever homilies or talks or teachings or read whatever self-help books or whatever. And I'm never going to come to a different way of seeing myself because my mode is I'm not lovable. So I'll just deflect everything else. Like, well, if you knew my past or if you knew this or if you knew that, or I'm not like other people who are special or whatever, you know. And so then we end up not receiving that stuff. I also think there's a way, I remember this myself, like when I was in that more of that, you know, needy, I hate that word because I was in that spot for so long. But when I was in that spot, like I remember it seemed like there was almost like a different species of people that it was just easy for. Do you know what I mean? And like, I wasn't like those people. And so those people needed to take care of people like me, you know, or something. Or, and then the more you really kind of do this internal work and realize like, okay, kind of there's a, I think there's a way where in the beginning it's a lot of work, right? But the more you get that in place, then it becomes like having pipes running water into your house, right? When you're, when the pipes are first being laid, I'm sure that's a lot of work. I've never done anything like that, but I'm sure it's a lot of digging and like, oh my goodness, and heavy and all the stuff. But once it's going, then, okay, there's a flow to it. And it's not so much work going forward, right? But it's not like that person who has the flow going is in any way inherently different than anybody else. And if, you know, somebody that, let's say the have, like, okay, I'm going to be really nice and go outside of myself and take care of this person in an ongoing way. Not that we, you know, aren't generous and charitable and whatever, but in an ongoing way, the fostering of that dependency does no big picture kind of favor for that person who's in that have not spot. If anything, it just is going to unintentionally, but like reiterate the message that you're not like me, you're not capable, and your peace and contentment is contingent on me instead of on, you know, on the Lord and your ability to really foster that relationship and take on the mind of Christ for yourself and that kind of thing.
So good. There's so much that I want to comment on. One of the things I just wanted to say was, I think what goes along with this neediness and relying on people in, you know, unhealthy ways is that we are almost like afraid of solitude. I think solitude gets kind of a bad rap because it's so important for growth, right? We have to like sit alone, like with ourselves and like you said, with God too, and kind of face ourselves. And I noticed in myself when I was kind of in these ruts of down spiraling into self-pity and neediness, I was kind of trying to avoid that. I was trying to avoid facing myself because it was scary, it was intense or whatever. And I think like when that's your posture of like, no, I'm going to take this fight like where it needs to go. I'm going to face myself and work on myself. I'm going to actually transform. At that point, plugging the right people into your life who can help you accomplish that is beautiful. Like I've had mentors come along me, like spiritual directors, therapists, like who then help me achieve that. But I'm not looking to them to do it for me. And like the author John Eldredge says, this kind of dynamic can often happen with men and women, where men, if they don't know that they're men, if they haven't like received that strength, that affirmation from other men, then they'll often go to women seeking that strength for the woman to like give him that strength. And it's just not positive. It's not how we're made. We can't do that. And so there's just this like constant vicious cycle of like, you know, I need you to be, like you said, my mom and give me strength and affirmation, when it's like, no, you need to go to God and other men in your life to receive that strength. And then you have that strength to offer to the people in your life, especially, you know, like your spouse, which I think is really, really good and beautiful. And so I think that there's a difference in posture when you go to mentors to kind of, you know, fill the need for you versus help you fill the need yourself.
Yeah. And I would even say like, so here's a feminine perspective on that. But I think you can even see that not so much as the man sometimes, right? But I'm just saying like what initially comes to mind when you say that is like kind of a weak man. This kind of like, you know, kind of more wimpy or whatever. But it can be insidious, right? It can also be the man who seeks out really weak women always has to be with a damsel in distress, right? I have to find somebody to rescue because that makes me feel strong. And I see that a lot. I see a lot of times like men just being attracted to like weakness because it makes them feel strong. But the sad thing in that is like, okay, if she ends up getting help and really becoming the fullness of who God's created her to be, that's going to change up that dance. And is it going to so threaten you and, you know, destroy the relationship? But because you don't want anybody being locked into, you know, weak in a way that's not who God created them to be, right? We're all called to grow into the full stature of Christ, you know?
No, so good. And I think we're hitting the right balance here because for anyone who's stuck in this situation right now, I want you to know, like, we feel you, like we get where you are. We've been there, like we're not putting you down in any way, but we love you too much to leave you there. We want to help you get to the spot where we know that you're going to be more functional, healthier, and thrive and experience a lot of joy. Like there's a lot of joy that comes along with learning how to stand on your own two feet, having the backbone, being able to, you know, relate to others in like healthy ways and not go to them to just, again, be constantly pouring into this kind of endless hole, this bottomless pit.
Right. And the lies that cycle tells you isn't fair to you because they're lies. Like, it's not the truth. There's nothing inherent about you and who you are, right? And so just understanding how these things fit together, I think, can kind of pull the curtain back on that and be like, what? Like, this isn't who I am. Like, you know, if it wasn't who you are and it's not who I am, and like, there must be something to this, because we were both in those spots. And now, you know, not that there isn't still ongoing, you know, growth. I hopefully there is for everybody as long as we're breathing, right? I think that's good news, though, you know, not bad news. And so just understanding how it fits together, and that, you know, if people are relating to you in a way that feels like consistently rejecting, you know, then it's not about who you are. Like, plug into the Lord first. Honestly, you know, there was a point a number of years ago, well, early years of practice, I remember thinking like, okay, the people in my world, because I'm single and live alone, the people in my world who need from me are really basically clients. So if I'm walking into the office to see somebody, that's somebody who's in need, which is true. But I came to realize, like, no, every time I walk outside of my house, there's people in need, you know? And so it doesn't become my job to take care of them. Like, I'm not the Messiah. Of course, still being kind and charitable and just kind of understanding that a lot of people are coming from a place of, even if they might seem like the ones that are the haves, right? You know, relational or emotional haves at any given time. Every day has troubles enough of its own, as scripture says, you know, and everybody's fighting a great battle, you know, another famous quote, you know, kind of thing. But just always kind of in my mind, I picture it like pipes, right? Like, if I keep the end of my pipe like connected to the Lord, then I look at myself as the desire to be like a conduit of grace, but it's His grace. It's not my grace. If I'm supposed to be a source of grace, I'm tapped out before I get out of bed. You know what I mean? Like, there's none there. But if we're plugging into the Lord, then anybody, even the people who feel like they're in that have-not spot, we can get to a place of feeling like we're starting with the needle on full instead of on empty, you know? And I think that's really possible for everybody.
No, I totally agree. And I think, like, yeah, knowing those healthy limits is so good, both for yourself and in relationship to other people. Yeah. And it ends up, again, making you healthier, happier. It's so good. And it just opens up doors that maybe you don't even think are possible to open. You don't even know because you haven't been there yet, but I promise it's worth it. But one final analogy, and then I wanted to share something from kind of the art world on this topic. So one analogy I like to think of when it comes to this, like, how do you, you know, kind of rely on people in a healthy way? And I think athletics is a great analogy. So if you think about it, you know, I was a baseball player for years, played different sports like football, volleyball, things like that. But it's like, you know, the coaches were there to help me, but they weren't going to lift the weights for me. You know, they weren't going to like run the sprints. They weren't going to field the ground balls. They weren't going to, you know, spend hours in the batting cage. Like, I had to do that. They were going to be there to like show me, you know, they were going to be there to like support me, to help me, to guide me. But they weren't going to get in there and do it for me. And I remember hearing this quote from Dave Ramsey too. He said, you know, God feeds the birds, but he doesn't throw the worms in the nest. Like, you got to get after it. And I think there's so much truth to that. And I think that could, you know, feel difficult for some people if you're like really in a tough rut. But it is, I think, taking that ownership and being like, okay, maybe you were dealt a tough hand in life, but it's like, you know what? I don't have a say necessarily over what happened to me, but from this moment on, I am taking ownership of the solution of my life. Like, I'm not going to let that write my story. Like, I want to write my own story. And I think there's a lot of beauty there. And a lot of people I've seen who've like transformed their lives, like they take that perspective. And one of my recent guests, Stacy, she said something like, broken is what happened to me, not who I am.
Absolutely.
And I think so often we walk through life thinking like, well, I'm just really broken and I'm always going to be like this. And, you know, again, there's a point to grieving. We'll get to that a little bit later, but at some point we got to like, you know, get after it, move on.
Yeah. Yeah. And shame on your coach if they did do the sprints and the batting cage and everything for you, because it cripples you and they're just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So there's a quote, I'm 99% sure the person this is attributed to is a guy named Frank P. Lehman. Not sure who he is, but I just remember coming across it at one point. It says, the kids the world almost breaks become the ones most likely to change it. It's, just, wow. It's beautiful, isn't it? Like, that having been one of those kids, like, it's that just like tugs at my heart every time. But I think there's something to that. I think there's a lot of hope in that. If you feel like you're somebody who's in that spot, then that means like you have a secret insight into the world and pain in a way that God can really use, you know, for you to be a very particular conduit of grace or healing or, you know, whatever it is in the lives of others or, you know, those around you or through your ministry, whatever, right?
No, so good. And that like gave me the chills, that quote, and it fires me up because like, yeah, I want to be that person, right? For other people just to speak vulnerably. And it's, yeah, no, it's beautiful. Switching from sports to art. So I think one of the other aspects to this whole struggle is that there's a lot of comfort in the familiarity. Like there's this weird thing that we kind of are comfortable in our own misery.
Sure.
Even if it's something that's bad for us, it's not leading us to a better place. And so the rapper NF, he's like this clean rapper. He has a song called Happy.
Are you going to rap this?
Yeah,
I think you should rap, Joey.
So it's him, you know, singing actually to God of all people. So he's singing to God, and in the song he raps these lines, which I won't make you all suffer through for me, but it's really, really good stuff. So he says, I don't know why, but I feel more comfortable living in my agony, watching my self-esteem go up in flames, acting like I don't care what anyone else thinks, when I know truthfully that's the furthest thing from how I feel, but I'm too proud to open up and ask you to pick me up and pull me out this hole I'm trapped in. The truth is I need help, but I just can't imagine who I'd be if I was happy.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a few different things going on there. Like obviously like the one point of like, it's not bad to ask for help. We're just saying to do it in the right way. So he kind of hits on that. I just wanted to clarify that point. But really that like, man, we're just comfortable in kind of the status quo. And I think it's really important to break out of that. So how do we break out of that and take action?
I think taking action is how we break out of it. I don't know that there's ever a point when it just becomes easy. In the beginning, right? It becomes easier by doing it. It's like lifting, right? Like lifting weights. The weight becomes lighter the more you lift it. But if it's something that's going to cause you to grow when you walk up to it, it's heavy initially, right? You have to start pumping it. And anytime we, you know, especially going back to the sports analogy, having played sports as well, when we don't have muscle memory of something yet, right? Feels really awkward, right? It's like, am I doing this right? Like, you know, I don't know. It just, you're having to concentrate on, you know, batting, right? Your stance, where are my feet? How am I holding my elbows? How am I following through? Like, okay, oh, watch the ball. That's a thing too. Like trying to put all these things together at the same time and not get beamed in the head, you know, and like whatever. But the more you do it, the more natural it becomes. And to the point where it's just, yeah, you don't even have to think about it. You just get up there and you're, you know, it just feels right and flows, you know, and actually becomes relaxing and enjoyable, you know. And then pretty soon you don't even, somebody else has to point it out to you that you're doing it, you know, and maybe not in terms of batting, but in terms of living in a healthy place or from that place of wholeness. So I think if we wait to want to do it or wait to feel equipped to do it or comfortable doing it, like we'll just keep on waiting. You know, I think it's just beginning to just starting and you tweak as you go and you grow as you go and learn more. But you got to start.
Yeah. And no, that's so good. And I think that's like the scariest thing for people. It's just starting. I could use another analogy, like the business world, right? It's a scary thing to start a business. It's intimidating. There's a complexity to it. There's all these steps that you probably know nothing about. And a lot of people, they like
risk.
Wait.
Right. Risk.
There's risk. Like, yeah, you can lose money. Like you can, you know, maybe put yourself in a really difficult situation economically. Like all these things, there's so much that goes into it, but it's, you know, so a lot of people then have this perspective of like, well, I'm just going to wait till I'm ready. And the really interesting paradox is like, you're never actually going to be ready. The only way that you'll be quote unquote ready is by actually like taking action and like learning what you need to know in order to take just like the next step. And then you knock down that barrier and then you go to the next barrier and you knock down that barrier and then you go to the next one. And that's basically entrepreneurship. It's just like a load of just like knocking things down, like going through walls. And then you look up, you're like, oh wow, I didn't feel like I was ready. I just did it anyway. And as I did, now I see like, wow, I'm like this far up the mountain and this is great. And I got a lot further to go, but man, if I was waiting to be, you know, get maybe, you know, one analogy would be like to get all this like perfect training or have like all the perfect people in your life who could tell you exactly what to do in any given situation. It's like, good luck. You really need to just like, you know, again, not saying that advice and guidance and learning isn't a good thing, but if it's just substituted for action, you're just digging yourself into a hole.
Yeah. I mean, something we've all experienced, whether we're business owners or athletes or not, right? Is like being a baby and like crawling and then walking. Like if a baby just sits there and ponders crawling and, you know, mommy plays a lot of YouTube videos about how to crawl properly, like it's never gonna, they're never gonna get across the room until they start doing it, you know? Even though, you know, I know you have a little girl, so like, you know, first baby has their butt stuck way up in the air and they're like trying to, can't manage their body weight, you know, and so they push themselves forward. Maybe they bonk their head as they, you know, haven't quite figured out how to move their arms in, you know, synchronicity with their legs and that bilateral kind of motion or what. But it's by doing it that we learn to do it. So you have done it before. Like everybody listening to this has done it before, you know, as long as it's somebody who's already crawled.
No, so good. And I want to circle back to an important point of like disability at some point. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But two things I wanted to mention. On the side of like being the coach or the parent, right? You actually have to let your kids struggle, which is hard. Like there's this real temptation when you see someone you love who's struggling to let them kind of continue going down that path. And it's really important, like when your kid's learning to crawl or walk, like they're going to take some falls. Like the goal, you know, there, at least as a parent, which is a little bit of a different role, is like you kind of want to make the environment somewhat safe so that they're not going to like get really hurt, you know, to the point where that would just be damage to them, right? But if they feel some pain, if they feel some hurt, as opposed to like the harm that we're talking about, then that's not a bad thing. And that's something you just have to kind of go through. And so, I think that's a hard lesson on being on the side of someone who wants to help, which I know we have people like that listening now too. But the other thing I was going to say is when it comes to like just starting, so yeah, you're right. Like there's people who will read books about any number of skills, like, you know, playing the violin, if we want to throw another analogy, it's like, great. Like you can read and watch videos and do all that stuff. But if you just pick up the violin and start playing, you're going to learn way more. And then that stuff will actually become useful than if you were to just like, you know, continue just learning. And the other thing I was going to say, I think a lot of people get discouraged to even act because they look around them and they see people who are like so much further ahead and they compare themselves. And the comparison leads them not to motivation where like, oh, wow, I admire what they've achieved. I want to achieve that too. I'm going to kind of try to learn from them and do it myself. It can really lead to like, well, I'm never going to be like that. Or they were so much further ahead. How could I ever catch up? And I think, you know, one quote I heard is like, don't compare your behind the scenes with everyone else's highlight reels. Because you're seeing someone who's likely put in a lot of effort over a lot of time, or maybe they just had like a different environment growing up, whatever, maybe they started a little higher in the mountain. And so we can't just like have that comparison. The comparison should just be used for inspiration. And then it's like, no, now I'm just going to fight my battle. The only person I'm competing against is myself. And I'm just going to keep trying to get better and better and better slowly. And that's another thing too. It's like the slow progress, like so much of, I mean, maybe this is just American culture, but I think it applies around the world a lot of times. It's like, we just want to see results instantly. Yeah. It's like, okay. I mean, if you go to the gym for a week, like your body's not going to transform. You go for a month, your body's not going to really transform. You might get a little stronger. You go for 6 months, okay, you're going to transform a bit, but it's not going to be like completely different. You go for a year, okay, now we're starting to see more results. You go for years, now we're seeing like an incredible, you know, transformation. But we all want to do like 30 days or like a couple months and see these incredible results. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, talking about the comparison thing, like it makes me think of what you and I were talking about before we started recording, and that was my concussions, right? So just that I had 9 concussions, all sports and car accidents, and didn't realize how much I was affected by those. But just recently having treated with a functional neurologist and having like amazing results from that, then like what people probably didn't know about me before was like, I couldn't read. I didn't read going through college. Thank the Lord, I'm an auditory learner. But, you know, somebody sees like, you know, how people relate to me sometimes is like, oh, like you're on a certain sort of pedestal, you know, and you're like, these people would say, have you read? And that's all they'd have to say. And in my mind, I'd be like, nope. They wouldn't even have to say the name of the book. I'd be like, is it on an Audible? You know, I've written a couple of books. I had to write the second one when the pandemic happened because I needed such uninterrupted time because words made sense coming out of my head, but I couldn't read over them to assess, okay, or pick back up when I left off, like what was I saying and jump in. They made no sense going in. So I had to have completely uninterrupted time to like kind of dump it all out. But then even that, going over edits and like, you know, is this a better way to say this or that? I don't know, because I don't know what I was saying to begin with. So, but you know, when not that they're great works of erudition or anything, or War and Peace or something, but people see, you know, you've written a couple of books, or you're a therapist, or you have, you know, you're on podcasts or whatever. Yeah, I was riding the struggle bus like big time. I couldn't read, you know. Like,
my goodness.
So yeah, so it's amazing, like exactly like you're saying about like seeing the highlight reels and not what's going on the backside, like just really struggling through. But by the same token, the Lord allowed that struggle, right? Mm-hmm. Until 54 years old. And he said, when you're talking about parents or coaches, like letting people struggle, that's how God did. But when I look back at it now, I'm like, wow, I feel like so charged up for like, oh my goodness, like glad that I didn't just kind of sit and be like, oh, well, I can't do it. And because, you know, it's kind of like, right, when you get into the, when you're on deck as a baseball player, what's that little ring that you drop on the bat that like adds weight to it, right? Mm-hmm. So
call it a donut, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, right. So it makes it heavier, right? So then when you get up and you actually are swinging, like you can like bring that bat around like really forcefully, because you were trying to do it like where it was like a lot more challenging, and now it feels easier, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of look at it like struggle is a good thing, but I think we should normalize struggle. Like struggle should be bad, because if we're not struggling in some way, like we're not growing, you know?
No, 100%. And I was listening to a podcast recently by like maybe a neurobiologist. Anyway, he was talking about a part of our brain that literally doesn't get activated unless we're pushing beyond our limits. And that part of our brain, I can't remember all the details, I'm sorry, but that part of our brain is connected to like longevity, like how long we live in our life, and like our ability to be productive and just be healthy people. And so like that's such a good thing to struggle, like you said, and in the right context.
Yeah. I think the only way to not struggle is complacency.
Yeah.
Really, right? Like, because there's always something to grow in, some area to grow in, you know?
And one tip here, one tactic is like, if you are stuck in that rut of complacency and apathy and just like, you know, not able to take action, or you feel like you're not able to take action, you always are able to take action, but you feel like you're not able to take action, I would maybe look at the people you're surrounding yourself with. Like, are they people who are maybe similar in the sense that they're kind of complacent and not taking action too? And then if you kind of slowly try to surround yourself with people, try to learn from people who are maybe doing what you want to do or be who you want to become, something amazing will happen. Like you literally will start kind of rising to that level over time. It doesn't happen all at once. But there's even like data on this. I don't have the study in front of me, but you end up making like similar money to like your closest like five friends, which is like bizarre if you think about it. And I think there's something similar, like when it comes to fitness too, like if you're spending time around people who like drink beer all the time and just like don't take care of their bodies, you're probably going to end up being like that, as opposed to, you know, someone who spending time with people who like work out regularly and, you know, they eat clean and all that stuff. Yeah. So I think that's one kind of practical, because I want to take this into the practical now too. But before we maybe get further into that, some people might be thinking like, well, what about disabilities? I think this is an important nuance that we add here. And I know maybe there's not an easy answer, but there are people who have legitimate disabilities. Like we're not just talking about like maybe learned helplessness or victim mentality, which I know that's kind of been the tone of the conversation, but we're looking more at like, you know, someone who maybe with Down syndrome would be maybe an extreme example. But I think maybe in the middle is a little bit more of a gray area, and people might even get a diagnosis about something, and then they maybe let that become the label. And I know there's like danger and all that too. So yeah, talk us through all that. Like what if someone truly does have some sort of a disability? How do they then take what we're saying and act on it?
Do you mean like emotional disability, physical disability? Like what, any particular thing you have in mind there?
Yeah, I mean, we could go any direction with this, but I guess since we're talking about like the emotional side, let's focus a little bit more on that. And I don't know if, you know, something like bipolar disease would be something to throw in there, or maybe that's too extreme of an example, but yeah, just something where people can point to something else and kind of maybe say, well, I have this, therefore I can never become that.
Yeah. I just look at diagnoses as they're just, they're a word that's used to describe a collection of ways a person is struggling, right? I just look at, I look at a diagnosis as like, it's a word that describes like how a person's doing. It's not who they are, right? Because you can think about people, even people under like arduous circumstances or struggling in really very limiting ways and yet making huge impacts on the people around them by who they are. And I think that's kind of maybe to take what we're talking about, like kind of brings it together, is like the taking action can sound a lot like about doing, but what I've always seen is like when we get the being right, the doing flows. And we as mental health, we are the first people to offend against this, because we'll talk about dysfunction. And I think dysfunction is, I'm trying to keep it clean, but it's not accurate. It's like, it's a faulty place to start, right? Like dysfunction, like we should talk about disbeing or disessence or something, because that's the problem. When we get the being right, the doing flows, right? Like the Lord comes and talks about the Beatitudes. He doesn't have to focus on the Ten Commandments. He knows if we're living the Beatitudes, like the Ten Commandments are taken care of, you know? Mm-hmm. Or like in therapy, usually the beginning of the week, if I'm working with a child and I ask the parent, like, you know, what's going on? They'll describe the behavior. But the end of the week when I'm like, you know, what's going on? They'll say, he's just so peaceful. He's just so loving. I don't have to say like, is he still throwing tantrums and breaking things? And, you know, I mean, it's kind of, they'd look at me like I had three heads. Like, did you not hear me say he's so peaceful? You know, and I think that if we focus more on our being, then the doing gets taken care of, right? It'll flow. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so in that sense, like we're not limited. Like our being would be how we would approach whatever diagnoses or whatever disability or whatever we have. There's still a you that is immutable in goodness and in the ability to strive towards being more, you know, plugged into the Lord. I mean, even if a person just focuses on really receiving God's love and lining up their thoughts of, you know, I like to tongue in cheek say, if you disagree with how God sees you, you're probably the one who's in error. Like probably just going to go out on a limb there, right? So if we even just focus on that, as I'm going to try to align how I see myself, how I relate to myself in terms of my self-talk and self-care more with how the Lord sees me. And like, I think that's something that we're all capable of, regardless of physical limitations or diagnoses or whatever, right? And like, the more we're plugged into that, I mean, God's all powerful and God is love. And the more we're plugged into his love and really receiving it, it's transformative, you know? So I figure let him do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, no, there's a bunch of lessons in that. One is we can't prescribe or get our identity from or describe ourselves, I guess, based on a condition or an experience alone, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that's really what diagnoses are, right? It's just saying, well, you have these symptoms and therefore this is the condition that goes along with those symptoms. Like I mentioned, bipolar disease or something like that. But you're right. You wouldn't like walk around and say, I am a bipolar man. Like maybe some people would say that, but this is kind of a weird thing to say. It's not accurate in my mind.
Can I jump on that? Because people do that regularly. They'll say my bipolar or my anxiety or whatever. And even though that might be a common way to talk, like it makes me bristle because I feel like it's not who you are. And it's really dangerous to like, to cling to that in such a way that's like ownership, you know, like why would you want to own that in some sort? I'm not saying be in denial about it. Okay, I'm struggling with anxiety, but I think that sounds far different. And I think that even just the what it kind of affects within the person is far different than saying my anxiety. It's like, are you aware there's a you that's immutable, that's still going to remain like when the anxiety's gone? Or is like how you see yourself so wrapped up with your anxiety that we kind of have to pry it out of your hands. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so no, I follow you.
I think it just begins to form how we see ourselves. And not saying being in denial about something, but as far as owning it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that's a good exercise where, you know, think through kind of how you would maybe describe yourself to someone like a friend or someone you're meeting, or even just how you maybe think about yourself. But I find it easier if there's like some sort of external person maybe you're talking to, and think through like, okay, how would I describe myself? And try to differentiate between the things that are true to your identity. For example, you know, I'm a man, I'm American, I come from an Italian bloodline. All these things I could say that are, yeah, just true to my identity compared to those things that maybe are just things that happened to you. Like, I'm a child of divorce, which I kind of have a love-hate relationship with that term because it just describes something I've been through. It doesn't slap an identity on me, though it sounds like it does. So I think differentiating between the two is maybe a good exercise for people to do if you guys want to. And then the other thing I was going to say too, I want to nuance, I think, the action and being thing a little bit more for people. I love what you're saying, and I think it's so true. I guess the one thing that I see maybe a little bit differently, or just, again, it's more of a nuance, is that there's often action needed to clarify the being, right? Because even in the example, and I know you'd agree with this, but even in the example of like the young person you were helping who, you know, their parent came in and was describing the dysfunction compared to the being at the end, the action that was between that change, that transformation, was actually working with you, right? And they were doing the work themselves, like the young person. You were just their guide and mentor, right?
Right.
But I think that's kind of an important distinction. So if someone's kind of just maybe looking in the mirror and being like, okay, like, this is who I am. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. I think you're only going to get so far. There are certain actions that maybe align with the identity that you, that's true to you. Like, you know, I don't want to throw too many more analogies around, but, you know, thinking of like, there's a difference between being someone who like goes to the gym to someone who's like into fitness. Like, it's kind of becomes, after so many actions, it eventually kind of is almost like integrated into your character. It becomes part of your being, so to speak. So I think there is like this interplay between action and being. And I think, and yeah, I need to agree with that, but I think it's important for everyone listening to think of it like through practically, like, okay, how do I exactly change my being? Like, it sounds like we need to learn the truth about who we are. That's important. That's knowledge. But then, you know, how do we then kind of make sure that we see ourselves that way and not some other way?
Yeah, I think, so a couple things come to mind. One would be like, I think you had mentioned like that solitude can be very challenging, right? So I would think like, and this is something that was a big game changer for me, and it was like internal stance. So even though it was invisible and it was about being, but it was actually doing something, it just wasn't like external action. Mm. So it was not external action. It was like, if I'm in a place of, whether it's really having like good news to celebrate or something difficult that I was suffering, to like go to the Lord with it first and share it with him first before I looked for, you know, the consolation or the joy of sharing it with somebody else.
Wow.
Not that it's bad to do that. I'm not saying that it's bad to have human support and relationships, but it's the primacy of that relationship. It begins to build a foundation of his reliable and sense of intimacy with him, and a sense of being known by him and that kind of thing, as really like primary and foundational. So it is more about being, even though it is action, right? You know what I'm saying? And another thing I think is to, if there's like the, you know, that tendency to compare myself to people on the outside and somehow find myself lacking, then it would be to like set up incremental goals. Like, the goal doesn't have to be, you know, just being this in this super like great emotional spot and I look like how I perceive these other people. Like, no, make the goals like incremental. You know what I mean? Make them where it's just, did I turn to the Lord first? Like, right? Did I turn to him first? Right? It doesn't have to be anything else, because I can control that. I think too often we can look at the outcome or the result that we don't necessarily have control over, as opposed to looking at our effort and setting goals having to do with effort.
No, I love that. That makes a lot of sense.
It's like, okay, if you go back to weightlifting, it'd be like, I want my bicep to be this many inches. Well, okay, good luck. Like, you don't know what's in your genetics or not, right? So you can contribute with, you know, diet and exercise, but you don't have control over how big your bicep is going to be. Like, you don't, you know, but you have control over, am I going to go to work out this many times? Am I going to eat right? Am I going to, you know, this many times a week or whatever, right? Like, so, so set goals by the effort instead of assessing it by the outcome.
Okay. No, that's really good. And I'm sure there's so much more we can say, but I want to just kind of circle back to the whole disability thing. I think one important distinction there is like, even if you're maybe so quote unquote like handicapped in some way, or you feel handicapped in some way, it's like, still do your best. Still, you know, still like, again, try to compete against yourself, become better tomorrow than you are today. And I think a great example of this is, I know, just backing up a little bit, I've heard of people, I don't know them personally, who do have like a disorder, and they are living like very like good lives. They're like almost like, I guess you can say they're thriving. Like, they're able to, I hate the word manage it, but it, in some ways they're able to like live with that thing that is maybe holding them back in some way. And I know this is a bigger conversation because I, like you, would probably think that, well, if they maybe healed the trauma behind it, maybe that symptom or that condition would like wrap up altogether. That's a separate conversation. So maybe this is a bad condition to pick.
Yeah, I think there still are people. I mean, yeah, it's the etiology of, meaning some people can be diagnosed with bipolar and it might not be an accurate diagnosis, but that's not to say the diagnosis doesn't exist at all.
Right? Yeah, but you can still live like a really good and beautiful and meaningful life. That's my whole point. It's
sure,
like
you, absolutely.
Don't make that an excuse for not, you know, trying or not living like a good life. You still can. There's people who do. In the show Reacher, actually, I don't know if people have seen that. You know, there's maybe some questionable content in it, but it's on Amazon Prime. The show Reacher, like Tom Cruise did some movies years back about this like army investigator who, you know, becomes a civilian. And anyway, he just like goes on and like solves these like crimes and things. But there's a show now with this actor who's just this enormous guy. And anyway, he's a great actor, but I just learned recently, I was listening to an interview, he has bipolar. And he is just like, from what I see, at least in some areas of his life, he's like kicking butt, like he's doing really well. So it's really cool to like look at people like that and see, okay,
sure,
even with maybe a little bit of a hand behind your back or something, you can still do really well. And on that note, I just wanted to just share with people, there's this Navy SEAL, his name is Ryan Jobe. And because again, people, I think we all can fall into this victim mentality and just think, well, I can't win. I'm just stuck. I just, you know, might as well just give up. And this Navy SEAL, Ryan Jobe, he was in Iraq, you know, and they were clearing buildings one day when he got hit in the face with a sniper's bullet. Okay, really rough situation. It didn't kill him, but in time he learned like he was completely blind. He wouldn't be able to see again. And he really, at that moment, could have just given up. Like he truly could have. Like it would have been, people, we would all probably would have given somewhat of a pass, right? Because of what he had been through. So he's blind. But he refused. He said, nope. Like, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to let this condition, I'm not going to let this injury define me. Like, I still want to live a good, beautiful, full life. And so as a blind man, he did incredible things. He summited Mount Rainier, which is like over 14,000 feet. A few people like die every year climbing this. To give context, as a blind man, he did it. You need specialized gear. There's ice typically. Like, it's not an easy thing. He climbed the thing. He trained for a triathlon. He earned his bachelor's degree with a 4.0 GPA. He successfully hunted an elk as a blind man. He married his girlfriend and they had a child. And so like hearing Ryan's story, it's like, well, yeah, his story could have ended very differently.
Wow.
But he just said, nope, I'm not going to be a victim. Let me just clarify that. He was a victim of, you know, an enemy fighter shooting him, but he said, I will not remain a victim. I think there's so much power in that.
And your favorite part's the elk, right?
Yeah, or the Navy SEAL part. I just love that. So, Margaret, there's so much more we can say. I guess in closing up the conversation, I just want to touch a little bit on grief. So I know through all of this, we're not saying that, you know, if you've been through trauma, you can just kind of skip over it and just kind of toughen up and deal with it and move on. You know, does grieving have its place?
Yeah, I think anytime there's been a loss, you know, whether it's, you know, realizing, coming to grips with kind of like what that person had told me, that's not fair. I deserve to have been taken care of as a child. Okay, well, there's a grief there. But you grieve it. The way to get to the other side of the grief is that you do something different going forward, you know. And so, yeah, absolutely. It definitely has its place. But, well, here we are sitting here like getting ready to be at Easter. So there's new life like on the other side. And that's how you get to the new life is through the grieving. It's part of the process. But then doing something different going forward, right? To me, as a person like overcoming trauma and the doing something different going forward was the kind of in my mind, like the bad guys don't get to win, you know, like my peace and contentment isn't contingent on somebody else. And I can do what I can do to be able to write a different story. Like that's not how the story ends kind of thing.
No, I love that. And my kind of layperson definition of grief is really like the process of accepting the new reality after the loss. And so it's like getting to that point is going to involve, you know, a lot of the typical things people talk about with grief. There's going to be, you know, sadness. There's going to be denial. There's going to be, you know, maybe the whole bargaining thing where you think, maybe I could have done this differently and prevented that. It's going to be anger. There's going to, but eventually that acceptance, I think, is where we want to lead. And it's a messy process. Like it's not linear and it does take time. I don't want to pretend that it doesn't. But I think if we, you know, look at someone who, you know, had a serious loss in their life and it's like years and years later, I don't know if we could put an exact timeline on like when you should be beyond grief or whatever, but if it's years and years later and they're still just like anchored on that grief, I think there's a problem there. Cause I think as helpful as all of that is, it's helpful. And I'm talking to myself as much as anyone. It's like, you know, I think it's easy to get caught up in the past and, you know, grieve. And then we need to ask the question, like, now what? And I think part of the problem, especially when in this topic of divorce, I want to like be very gentle here, because so often when your family falls apart, there's a lot of dysfunction, your parents get divorced, like there's a separation, like whatever the particular case is for everyone listening, it's often just not even treated as a trauma. It's not even treated as something that you need to grieve. It's not even treated as a loss. And so a lot of people might be showing up to this episode or this podcast just thinking that, well, you know, they're just learning that it was a loss. Maybe mm-hmm. they kind of felt that on some level, but it wasn't conscious. And then now they're like, okay, now I need to grieve that loss. Totally get that. And I just want to, you know, give you guys grace there, of course. But we're kind of talking about the situation where that, you know, I think I've fallen into in the past where it's like, I'm just going to grieve perpetually forever. And I'm never going to kind of accept the new reality and move on in life. And I think that's like really, really dangerous. Again, I think in time, we need to find meaning in the midst of our reality right now, today, learn how to accept it and really live and even thrive in the midst of it. And again, I think it's really important to ask that question, like, now what? And so that's kind of one of the final questions I'd throw to you. Like, how can someone best answer that question, now what?
How can they best answer the question, now what, of like meaning like the new reality going forward? I think like, you know, I heard this homily once. This was decades ago. I'm old enough that it was really a number of decades ago. But I loved it because he said, like, if you want to know, like, what's the Lord really like calling you to be in a particular way to glorify him, you know, for us as Catholics, like be a saint. It's like, look at what area of your life you've really struggled. Right? I mean, like you were in a divorced family. Like I had a whole lot of trauma. You've now ministered to people from divorced families and I'm a trauma therapist, right? You know, or he was talking about, you know, St. Peter, who was a sand pile. He was crumbling all over the place, sticking his foot in his mouth. And then like the Lord makes him, you know, the rock, right? Or Mary Magdalene, who's so much, you know, impurity in her background. And then like just renowned for like just, you know, passionate, like single-hearted love for the Lord, you know? So looking at what area like you're particularly challenged by, and I think that can begin to give you some inkling of the now what. I liked your definition, right? Accepting the new reality going forward, but it's not just about accepting, it's living into that new reality. And I think that can point us into the direction of what's the new reality.
No, I love that. And I think another way to ask that question, now what, is like, what am I going to do with this? Like this happened, like, what am I going to do with this? Like, yes, take time to grieve, you know, all of that's very important, but it's like, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to let it define me? Am I going to let it limit me in life, hold me back like we've been talking about? Or am I going to then take that and use that as a catalyst for growth? Because really pain, I think, and suffering and trauma in life can either, you know, just kind of destroy us, or we can use it as a catalyst for growth. And I mentioned Dave Ramsey before, I remember him saying like the difference between him and a lot of other people is like he, and really anyone who's like a high performer who's been able to, you know, gain any sort of like success in life is like, you're just standing on top of like the pain and the struggles in your life instead of just being buried under them. Like that can be like your ladder to climb up. And so I think there's a lot of hope in that. And like you said, just maybe looking at people in your life or where you might feel called to then pour into others in a healthy way is a really beautiful thing as well. It's a good outlet. And I know for me, that was like actually a really healing thing to look beyond my own pain and try to find people in my life who maybe were suffering even more than me and see what I could do again to love them in a healthy, like balanced way. And so any final thoughts on that before we close on?
Yeah, just for me, it's, you know, kind of like what you're saying, but like about becoming that person your little kid wished they had had back then.
Yeah. And then, you know, taking that and like trying to help people to help themselves. I think that's like so beautiful. Like we were talking about before, where it's like, we need to really grow that ability to kind of lead that little kid inside of us, that hurt part of us that maybe wants to freak out, that wants to stay stuck, that wants to grieve forever, that wants to play the victim constantly. And it's really beautiful to know that like, okay, no, we can be that person who leads us out of that misery, that stuckness into a much better place.
Yeah. And then chances are there's other people struggling the same way. They're that little emotional part of them struggling in the same way. And when you come to that understanding or way of being able to be that for that part of you, then you probably have a gift to offer a lot of people. who are in that same place, you know?
Yeah. And there's countless stories of people who've done that, who've used that pain and transformed, like you said, transformed other people's lives or helped them transform their lives. So good. In closing, I just want to say thank you so much and just really always enjoy talking to you. And just, yeah, our partnership has been great. So I appreciate you and thanks for being here. Two final questions, I guess. One, like, tell us about what you offer and how people can find you online. That's one thing. And then the second thing, I just want to throw the final word to you and just any final encouragement, any final advice to everyone listening who's maybe, yeah, just been stuck in this problem of helplessness or victim mentality. Like, what's the final encouragement and advice? So tell us about your work and then tell us about that final word.
Sure. So I'm a trauma therapist and I do intensive outpatient trauma therapy, which typically looks like 1 week, all day, every day for Monday through Friday. And I do human and spiritual integration workshops in person for groups or online. I have a couple of books, More Than Words, The Freedom to Thrive After Trauma, that's specifically about trauma, obviously. And that's available on Amazon, as is Fearless, Abundant Life Through Infinite Love, which talks a lot more about what my final word would be, which is really just directing those needs for connection, for being chosen, being known, being valued, being protected and provided for, to the Lord first, and then aligning our thoughts with His, taking on His mind for ourselves, and by way of that, being able to become conduits of grace to others. So that's available on Amazon as well. But that, I think that for me, that's the final word. It's really about plugging into the Lord first. I mean, we can talk about His love like it's a nice thing and it's, you know, it's, yeah, just kind of a nice thing. It's optional, but it's like, it's really everything. It's the most powerful force there ever was, and it's transformative. And I know that personally and would never have thought that my life could look the way it does, given all the things that I, you know, had been through. So, but it was boiled all down. It was all God's love. So can't be overstated.
I want to touch on one additional barrier problem that we might face, and that is, if this problem I'm facing has attracted people into my life who want to help me, what happens to those people once this problem is solved, once it goes away? Will they just disappear? It is kind of a scary thought, and maybe subconsciously can lead us to kind of holding on to, becoming attached to whatever problems that we're facing in our life, because it kind of got us the result of getting attention and getting people, to help us. I can't tell you exactly what would happen if you were to solve that problem, but I can say that if you were to intentionally or subconsciously kind of hold on to that and never outgrow that problem because it brought people into your life and in order to keep them in your life, I can say this, eventually it will likely drive them away. And I don't say that to scare you. I don't say that to make you think that everyone's going to abandon you. That's not the case. But if we're holding on to it again subconsciously or maybe even intentionally to keep those people around, something's going to change. Eventually, they're going to get wind of this. Eventually, they're going to kind of understand or have a feeling that, okay, maybe this isn't the healthiest situation because this person might be relying on me in an unhealthy way. And so just wanted to talk through that. And I say that with a lot of grace because, again, I've been in these situations before. But if you were to heal and outgrow that problem, then what I would say is you then would have the opportunity to build a much healthier relationship, a much healthier friendship. You'll be able to really just be a better friend to them. And that should secure, that should make sure that you'll have a better, longer relationship with that person than if you were to just hold on to this problem that's brought them into your life. And whether or not you struggle with that, I wanted to issue a challenge to everyone listening. And the challenge is this. If you struggle with helplessness or neediness or just never seeing much transformation in your life, don't just talk about your problems. Don't just think about your problems. Don't just listen to podcasts and read books. Those are good things, by the way. I'm not putting them down, but don't just do those things. Take the advice, take the lessons, and put them into action. That's how you see the results. Execution, right? Even if it isn't perfect execution, even if you kind of stumble through it, even if you're not very competent at whatever it is that you're doing, that's okay. It's better to act. Even if you feel like you don't have time, whatever barrier you're facing, just bulldoze through that barrier and execute, execute, execute. Do it, do it, do it. And I promise in time, you'll see some results. And if you want more from Margaret, I'd recommend checking out her website. That's linked in the description. We also filmed a course with her. It's called Broken to Whole, Tactics to Heal from Your Parents' Divorce or Broken Marriage. And by signing up, you're going to learn from Margaret. And again, she's an 18-year trauma therapist. You're going to learn why the trauma of your parents' divorce or family dysfunction is so damaging. You're going to learn simple tools and tactics to navigate your emotions and heal, tips to build healthy relationships. And the whole course is actually 2 hours long. It's not super long, and it contains about 30 videos. Most of them are 2 to 5 minutes long, so it's very digestible. You can work through it at your own pace. And by going through the course, you're going to really be armed to identify the root of your struggles, which so often is trauma, untreated trauma. You're going to feel validated and less alone in your struggles. You're going to understand and better navigate your emotions. You'll build healthier relationships and a better life. And you're going to, most importantly, avoid passing your brokenness onto the people that you love the most. And so if you want to get the course right now, it's free. That might change in the future, but right now it's for just click on the link in the show notes. Again, you can sign up for free at this recording. It is free. That, again, that might change in the future. And then you could begin watching the videos at your own pace. Again, just click on the link in the show notes. That wraps up this episode. If you know someone who's struggling from their parents' divorce or broken marriage, feel free to share this podcast with them. I promise you, they will be forever grateful to you for sharing it with them. I really wish someone would have done that with me years ago. In closing, always remember, you are not alone. We're here to help you feel whole again and break the cycle of dysfunction and divorce in your own life. And keep in mind the words of C.S. Lewis, who said, "You can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending."